Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 16th, 2005. This session is entitled, Homeless, Would Most of Us Choose to Repeat Our Lives? Presented by Michael Pellet in the Fireside Room. Disc number POM-2005-05. Let's listen in.
Please. And welcome. This is our fourth session on evil. My working title for this session is called Evil Are Us. And so it's more the personal dimension, or how we see or don't see evil at work in our lives. And so, again, what I've tried to do in all of these sessions is look at different ways that people have experienced evil and tried to talk about evil. So in the first session, we looked at natural disasters and asked a question about natural evil. And is there such a thing as natural evil, and what might that be, and what does that have to say as well about our understanding of God and the world? In the second session, we looked at what is considered, and I think properly so, the greatest instance and example in our contemporary world or in the 20th century, and that's the understanding of Auschwitz, the Holocaust, and how evil is understood there. In the third session, we tried to talk about 9/11. And what experiences and understanding of evil that would be. And now in this session, like I said, it's going to be more, use a fancy word, existential understanding in terms of how evil might work within your own lives and how you may be understood sometimes as evil or not evil and what that would entail. And to try to get at that, kind of three discussions. So we'll divide our session into three parts, and we'll get to all three if we're really lucky. And those are the three questions that I have on the board. That first one is, would you live your life over again if given the chance? And second question is, how can life itself be justified without justifying the evils that call it into question? And third question is, can we ever be at home in the world? In that sense of having a home and feeling so comfortable and safe and secure, if you will, home there as a metaphor. So to start it off, and I know that's a hard thing to do on a Saturday morning, which is think, I'm asking you, let's think about this first question. Would you live your life over again if given the chance? And just anyone, if you're willing,
you mean
respond.
Without any modifications?
My question is an open question. How you want to qualify it will help us understand the evil that is you.
Now we really want to talk.
That's an open question.
No, that last one is just my cynicism. No, I don't want to add that qualifier, because then again I'm loading the question even more. So if that's what you think is part of your answer, then that's fine. I just want to know, how would you answer that question? Would you live your life over again if given the chance?
Only if I knew then what I know now.
Yeah. All right. What do you know now?
The things I wish I had not done, and the things I've left undone that I didn't do.
Ooh. Just like Paul.
Right.
Romans 7. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Well, I guess I would say yes, but a little bit like that.
only if we could change the things. I always say we were born too soon because kids, I'd like to have the opportunities the kids have today. I'd like to be international.
Yeah.
And that's the way I'm talking. I'd like to be able to do things. But I wouldn't like to go back to the beginning where I wasn't new exactly.
I think it's Oscar Wilde has the great statement that I believe more and more now. It's a shame that youth is wasted on the young.
Yeah.
I don't think I would.
You wouldn't live your life over again, no?
Just delay the inevitable. And the inevitable seems better to me than living my life over again.
Who's giving the chance?
Michael.
I just said, if given the chance.
That man has a lot more power than you realize.
Yes, please.
I would say no. I'd go along with her. I feel, just through the things that have happened in my life, that I feel more and more do something with the day you were given and quit trying to live in the past. Go forward.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. I think by and large, I would not want to live my life over again. I think where I would be tempted to do that, though, would be where I've been risk averse, where I haven't taken the risks that that I could have taken.
Okay, anyone else? Paul.
I absolutely would, without any question. And I've had close deaths. I mean, a brother, a mother, of course, at my age, your mom dies. So I've had profound grief in my life. I've raised two kids with my wife, and that, of course, is everybody knows it's raised kids. I would do that over too. And I have this little, if I can add, this little kind of theological sense that I think the universe is absurd. And I think that in that notion, we don't know whether, I mean, men and women create evil. And that's some kind of illogic. But then there are earthquakes and tsunamis and stuff that's just absurd. You happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But into that absurdity, I believe that God entered, not to change the absurdity, but to live with us through that. And because of that, I've been kicked in the teeth, in fact, kind of a lot. Well, no, not a lot. Many have more. But I've been kicked in the teeth, too. I would still live it over, because I believe that I'm not alone through all that. Mm-hmm.
I would make some different decisions.
Oh, amen.
But again, as was mentioned earlier, it's only in hindsight that you can see that. But and if I made had started my life over again, I'd make different bad choices.
I hope not one. But
yeah.
We'll discuss that.
A separate discussion.
Yeah.
My earlier life. No, it's decisions that shut down possibilities, or you know, that were not very life-giving.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I think about this, and sure, I'd like to live my life over as I think and feel now, because I can kind of navigate a little bit better than my younger years. But I was just thinking, the only possibility I can think of, and it's kind of a challenge to everyone, I think, is that can we live our life over by going through, by being around every person that we can find that's younger than us? You know, like being around a newborn for maybe 3 weeks and just, I mean, follow, nurture, you know, just trying to get into their, maybe a three-year-old, do that, you know, a college person, just follow them and be with them, you know, just live that life instead of, in a sense, wanting them to come to where you are, or, you know, having, you know, just listening and being there with them. You know, I think that would be just a very exciting life for a while, if you had the freedom to do that. Because I think that would kind of bring you back and have you live that time over again. Because I know I do it as a parent, definitely. But it just perked that one. I thought that'd be really fun.
My mother used to have a saying, and I can't remember exactly how it goes, but the idea is that if everybody had a choice, and they bundled all of their troubles in a bag and put it on a pile, and you had a choice to go and get either your own bundle or another or someone else's bundle, everyone would take their own bundle of troubles back rather than a bundle that you don't want.
Yes, the known is always a little easier to answer. And I guess that's why I asked the question at the very beginning. If you, you know, could make some changes, the same thing you said, if you could take what you know now, I think it would make for a very rich experience the second time around. Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a few quotations in terms of Western philosophy. If you'd ask Western philosophy, would you live your life over if given the chance? They would practically unanimously say no, which is kind of interesting. And I have some quotations here from a few philosophers. I mean, you really can go anywhere in philosophy, in Western philosophy, and basically find a no answer. And so the reason I picked these folks is because I think they're kind of pithy sayings and have a kind of catchy way of saying it. But just to give you a sense of what people think, the first one is, never to have been born is the best life there is. That was by Sophocles. So you can see in the very beginning of the Greek, this is from the play Antigone. Antigone says that when she has to make the decision whether to bury her brother or obey the law in the city. Both decisions mean suffering and problems for her, and so she says, never to have been born is the best life there is. So think, there you go, that's a great thought. Huh? Here's a quotation from the rationalist philosopher Leibniz, who lives in the 17th century. He says, had we not knowledge of the life to come, I believe there would be few persons who, being on the point of death, were not content to take up life again, on condition of passing through the same amount of good and evil, provided always that it were not the same kind. One would be content with variety without requiring a better condition than that wherein one had been. That's kind of like Renita's last statement that, if we wouldn't know the life to come is better, if we'd have to live this life again, we'd do it if we could basically pick up the same bundle. Now, we certainly wouldn't want more evil than good. This is two quotations from Voltaire. Most of us would, at death's door, choose to take our lives back. But this is a wish born from terror, fear of the unknown. So in other words, it's not that life is so good, but it's you just don't know what's after it, so you say, well, I guess I'll stick with what I know. His second quotation. People would rather die at once than die of boredom. There you go. Mm-hmm. Probably thinking that right now as you're sitting here. This from the British philosopher and skeptic, Scottish philosopher and skeptic, David Hume. Ask yourself, ask any of your acquaintance whether they would live life over again the last 20 years. No, but the next 20, they say, will be better. This is from the German poet Goethe. In all times and all countries, things have been miserable. Men have always been in fear and trouble. They have pained and tortured each other. What little life they had, they made sour one to the other. That which perhaps gave or gives them some degree of attachment to life was and is the fear of death. Schopenhauer, 19th century philosopher. No person has existed who has not wished more than once that he had not to live through the following day. Accordingly, the shortness of life, so often lamented, may be perhaps the best thing about it. For whence did Dante get the material for his hell, if not from this actual world of ours? Happy thoughts. And two quotations from Nietzsche, who again, interestingly enough, in all of this, is the most positive about life, right? I think, you know, poor Nietzsche has sometimes been misunderstood about this. Nietzsche would actually be positive on life. It's the first quotation here. In every age, the wisest have passed the identical judgment on life. It is worthless. Everywhere and always, their mouths have... their mouths have uttered the same sound, a sound full of doubt, full of melancholy, full of weariness with life, full of opposition to life. And the last quotation, and again, Nietzsche. Instead of saying simply, I am no longer worth anything, the moral lie in the mouth of the decadent says, nothing is worth anything. Life is not worth anything. There you go. So now that I've cheered you up. But isn't that interesting? I mean, and again, Nietzsche's last, that quotation there too, is it, as he says, if you look at all the kind of wisdom of the West, they'll all tell you life is worthless. Life isn't worth it. You know, you wouldn't live it over again. Or that sense of the only reason you live it is because you're afraid of dying. And that seems to be worse than living, because at least living, you know what hell is all about. Right? Mm-hmm. To use that Dante-esque phrase there. Right? So now, a little bit here to contemplate that some more, and in terms of your own responses about why you would or would not live your life over again. The way I think what's happening here, or to think about this, theologically, takes us right back to Genesis 1 and that notion that as God creates, and remember, after each day of creation, except for the sixth day, there's a little bit of a gap there, but after each day, God looks at what God has made and then says what?
It's good.
It's good. And you see, quite frankly, human beings don't believe that. Right? That understanding, creation is not good. Life is not good. In other words, what that entails is somehow it's flawed. And if you think creation is flawed or your life is flawed, by implication that goes back to saying somehow God is flawed. Because after all, God is the designer, right? One of the arguments for the existence of God is called the argument from design, that God is the great architect who designs and creates the world. So after all, I mean, think of this building here, Koinonia. If this building is flawed, why would it be flawed? Because the designer or the builder must have put some flaw into it, must have made some kind of mistake. And that already gets us back to a basic understanding of evil. Because evil is some notion of flaw. There's a mistake in the design. Somewhere it goofed up. And so when asked whether or not you would live your life over again if given the chance, and you say no, somehow you're saying there's a flaw. That if you want to say you as the designer of your own life didn't do such a good designing job, didn't do a very good job of building your life, there's a sense of evil there. Or if you say basically, no, life is good, even if you want to call it absurd, but affirming the absurdity of it all and still going with it, you're basically saying the design, whatever it might be, or even no design at all, that's still okay. That's what we have. And so there's that basic sense and understanding, I think, that's going on there. And again, I think it's that understanding that we have theologically of a good God who creates a good world, of a gracious God, of a loving God, who is there for us, with us, that enables us to affirm life, all of life, including our own lives, which I think, quite frankly, is the most difficult to affirm. We usually can affirm something else other than ourselves simply because we know ourselves that well. But I think that already is one of the senses of how to think about evil and implications that might have for our understanding of creation and God. Any other comments folks want to make about this topic or this question and a little bit that I said on that before we move into the second question? Yes, please.
Yes, well, I'm not thinking ever that it isn't good. It's that every rock has had a revelation. God's had to deal with me. I don't look at that as, in my choices, I usually have the wrong idea, but he patiently walks with me, and somehow there's this wonderful experience, or tough experience, but you learn and grow through it. And so consequently, I look forward to each stage of, I am the clay, and he is the potter, and he's got a new job for me, and he's making me into something new each time. So not in respect to thinking that the creation is evil, ever. That was our blow as humanity.
Okay. Anyone else want to say something about this before we move on?
I couldn't help but, just as you were reading those quotations, I countered with quotations I just took off the top of my head from literature. And there's a story, I can do this real fast. There's a story by a Swedish writer where the people are all living in heaven and they want to figure out what life means, so they seek out God and they come to him. The story is The Eternal Smile by Parlagraphist. And they find God, and God says, I only intended you need not be content with nothing. That's it puts a lot of responsibility on human beings, but it's an affirmation of life. The other ones are,
Wordsworth says, "For all that I've lost, I've had abundant recompense." I mean, it's not negative, it's a positive thing. Styron, at the end of that Holocaust novel that is so full of sorrow and anguish, says, "It's not Judgment Day, it's only morning, bright and fair." Milton, after he wrote Paradise Lost, wrote Paradise Regained. who, raising in the sun. Lorraine Hansberry, she's 34 years old, she's dying of cancer, she knows she's dying, and she writes an essay, "I wish to live because," and I wish millions and millions and millions of others to live. And this is a woman who's been harassed by racial epithets, she's worked in the inner city, and she had been kicked in the teeth a lot, and writes an essay, "I wish to live." And what was the other one? Keats, and then I'll shut up. "Beauty is truth, truth, beauty, that's all you know on earth, that's all you need to know." So the poets, who have also been kicked in the teeth, and I know you know that, Michael, I'm just sharing. There's a flip side to those guys that are.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, and that's where our second question goes. I mean, it's a good segue into that, and that is, how can life itself be justified without justifying the evils that call it into question? And that is a philosophical and a theological question. That's one of, I think, the real blood and guts questions that are addressed constantly in the scriptures, that we need to address every Sunday, if you will, in worship. And I think we do address it every Sunday. But what do you think about that one? And this is a tough one. Now we'll really separate the thinkers from the right?
Thinkers from the feelers?
Yeah. Right? How can life itself be justified without justifying the evils that call it into question? I mean, Paul has given us a clue in terms of saying, think about literature and all of those authors who have tried to do some of that. I mean, I think that's one of the places where that happens, is precisely in art, whether that's literature, poetry, painting, music. But how for you? How would you answer that question? How could you go at that?
My first thought is, it is what it is, and who are we to justify it?
So you think we should? You think it's a bad question? Just erase the question. Go to number three. Go to seven.
You know, but life is what it is, and there are things that are beyond us, and how we deal with it is what makes us tick, and it has a lot to do with our approach, our philosophy or theology, I guess. And ultimately, if God is bigger than us, then who are we to justify or not, but to receive it as a gift, I guess.
Okay. Any others?
And a sort of a spin-off on that, I almost feel that the question is trying to resolve a tension that we can never resolve. So I think part of life is living with that tension and living with paradox and being able to hold two things that disagree with each other and go on anyway and not try to settle it. You know, it's almost that old question, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, they do. And I don't know that there is an answer to that.
Okay. How would we know how good life is if we didn't experience some bad?
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I don't know. So, you know, that's the kind of question to say I'll pound your head against the wall for a while just so you have the experience of knowing what pain is not.
I don't say that bad.
When Rabbi Marx is here, he talked about opposites. And what he didn't mention but that I thought of was suffering and hope, that suffering brings hope. And how would you not know the good without knowing the bad? You know, when I read the scriptures, when I read the Psalms and Jeremiah, it's most meaningful in light of very dark situations. Like if I'm thinking about the Holocaust, or because my life has not been so horrible, but when I think of the experience of the Holocaust and what those words must have meant in a time of great suffering, then there's great hope there.
The only thing I would say to that is that if we say, how would we know what the good is without knowing some of the bad or evil, that's a very sneaky way of precisely justifying. Right? To say, well, that's how I justify the bad things that happen in my life. They help me now understand the good things. And, you know, and you go, oh, yes, but really, is that the way we want to go? You know?
Doesn't Job say that? You know, was it Isaiah that says, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And Job says, what is man? I wish you weren't quite so mindful of us.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the plug, because next week in the Bible study, I'm going to be studying Job.
I'm going to be here.
Precisely to ask some of these tough questions. Yes, Michael, please.
Yeah, I came in on the discussion late, so I may be clueless, which wouldn't be such a surprise. But it strikes me that question B has a kind of normative quality to the first part that isn't fully explicated. I mean, the question of, There's an unsaid phrase that life is good, right? That's the assumption. How can life be justified? Namely, that it is good without justifying the evils that call it into question. And for me, I think there are two thinkers that come to mind immediately that have been important for me. Thomas Merton, the American Catholic monk, and Ludwig Wittgenstein, the Austrian philosopher of language and mathematics. And with regard to Wittgenstein, I thought of him when Paul was giving various quotations of people. But there's a kind of transcendent movement that artists can make that those who are not artists can only be, I think, envious of, and to look back. So Wittgenstein, who had this fantastic life of the mind, creating in a sense two different philosophies in one lifetime, and suffering a great deal interpersonally and from cancer at the end. So he's had this hard life, and he tells those who are gathered around him at his deathbed from cancer, he says, tell them I've had a wonderful life. And that's very mysterious, and that ties into what Wittgenstein talks about when you're thinking about language. He says there's some things in religion, there are some things that you can't express, that you have to be silent. They are what are that's what is mystical. And I think it's a kind of transcendent mysticism that you can say life is good, even in the awareness that life has not been perhaps so good for you personally, and certainly not for many others. And then here, to really be quick about it, Thomas Merton comes to mind, because sometimes when we're looking back on how our journey toward God, where it took a decisive turn, or how we were converted, that then Merton suggests that we can look back at our lives, and the conversion can happen in a kind of retrospective movement, looking back over our shoulders. That, so even though there's no way empirically to have changed any event that happened in the past, because it is in the past, and by definition then unable to be altered, somehow it is altered in a kind of retrospective movement of God's grace, that you can see things, you can say, now I see why that happened or that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Yes, please.
I don't know if I can articulate this very well, but my son and I were having an argument, and he said, well, if there is a God, there wouldn't be any pain in the world, okay? So after we got done talking, I just sat down and did a list of all the different pains that there are in the world. You know, loss and health and death and poverty and, you know, and you can get, you know, you can, okay, a world without this, a world without this, a world without this. And even time can be evil because time can, so you get rid of time. What have you got? You've got death. Now, the problem with that is you come around again to, does that mean life is pain? Is, you know, so you come right back to that question that you're asking. But if you try to imagine a life in which God provides a world where there's no pain, no pain at all, then you have to eliminate virtually everything that we call life. Does that make sense? Did I?
Yes. No, okay. I think that may, I mean, in other words, to, you know, get rid of all pain, you just have to kill life. Which is a pretty radical solution, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know that it got me around to, it still justifies, it's an argument that justifies pain, which right. We can call evil.
And if you will, it's the point that Sophocles, right? Never to have been born at all is the best life there is. Why? Because you don't experience anything. Isn't that great? Right? I don't have any pain. I don't have any joy. I don't have any... Why? Because I don't exist. Hey, that's great! Except one problem. I don't exist. But, you know, that's a minor one, right? Not a big deal. I mean, that's the irony in all of that. And part of that, I think the question, and it's a little bit of a trick question, and you know, Michael was too smart in all of that, is that the problem is, you know, as soon as you start trying to justify, you're always going to run into difficulties. Because the whole question of life, and if you will, the evils within life, whatever it will be, I mean, again, kind of by definition, what makes the experience of evil evil is that it goes outside of all the neat boundaries of rationality and morality and theology that we want to place on. Right. I mean, I think that's where Wittgenstein was taking us with that thing. I mean, you cannot give that airtight, rational, moral, even theological argument or reason for life. So what's the response to it? I'll just throw this out as one suggestion. And that is, I think, go back to John 3:16 of all places, right? For God so loved the world. And again, within the Lutheran tradition, we would say, well, what does that notion of love mean? Well, we would say that is justification by grace through faith for Christ's sake. Note how we sneak that word justified in there, huh? but note, in some senses, it's using justifying in a very different way in terms of we're not trying to justify life or evil or anything, but rather talking about it as love. In terms of whatever happens, to use Paul's language again, it's all absurd. And how is one going to justify absurdity, if you want to think of it that way? And what happens to you at times? Those contingencies, chances, whatever. But the notion there is, can you love what is seemingly so absurd? And to say that there again, it goes beyond the realms of our reason, that loving the world requires grace, that key attribute of God that God is gracious. And that even, and I think this is what the cross demonstrates, and what Luther's theology of the cross demonstrates, is how God is gracious and loving in the face of evil. And so there again, to say, if we really want to crunch our brains on this one, let's take that tough case of Auschwitz. And to say, even in the midst of Auschwitz, where certainly there's no way you can justify it, there is no way that you want to pronounce that somehow the evils of Auschwitz will come out for good. And yet, even in that condition, can we say that God's graciousness and love is at work?
Viktor Frankl said so.
Right. Mm-hmm. And even Elie Wiesel, who puts it in terms of in his book Night, and talks about that young boy who was hung, and you know, how could you justify it in that, and how do you understand the Holocaust? He would summarize it in the one word, madness, or the word that Paul, absurdity. And yet, Wiesel would say, if you ask, where was God in all of this, he would say, in that boy hung there, right? That somehow, even there, in that funny, absurd way, there is still some sense of graciousness or love or whatever at work. Certainly not justifying. And so there for us, and again, I think in our lives, can we face the evils, even the evils within us, in our lives, around us, in ways that are gracious and loving? I think that's our challenge. The flip side of that, and for this I go to Hannah Arendt. Just one quotation from Hannah Arendt as she talks about Auschwitz and specifically about Eichmann. This is from her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem. She says, quote, "To find my way around in reality without selling my soul to it the way people in earlier times sold their souls to the devil." And then she says, "Eichmann sold his soul." And a little later on, she says, "Souls generally go at bargain rates." That one is just too sadly true, isn't it? For all of us, isn't it? Right? I mean, in some senses, again, my cynical self says, "Well, I know we all sell our souls." But, you know, why do we sell them all at bargain rates? I mean, can't we at least go for a high price? But, you know, that's kind of the tragedy of human existence, isn't it? We really sell out cheaply.
That's because it's a wholesale market.
It is, yeah, right? I mean, why sell yourself retail when you can sell wholesale, huh? I don't know. I think Arendt is right on to something, right? Souls generally go at bargain rates. And that was her judgment on Eichmann, right? I mean, he sold his soul way too quickly. And I think the judgment on us, whatever the situation may be. And that in terms of, rather than loving the world and acting that way, we just simply sell out. And therein lies some of the evil that is there. Any other comments or things that you want to make on this second notion about justifying and a sense of perhaps the alternative to justifying this notion of loving and a sense of graciousness that does not try to justify, but is still in relation with the world, with our lives, but again, too, not a sense of selling out. You all think that's right. Wow. All right, then let's go to the third one. Can we ever be at home in the world? And here again, home obviously is a metaphor. And in the little blurb for today, the German philosopher Immanuel Kant says that basically, again, in the Western tradition of philosophy, as he looked at it, and he was writing here at the very end of the 1700s, but he says, usually, home has been categorized as a cheap inn, as a prison, as a madhouse, and as a latrine. And so now,
yeah.
What's your home like? Which one of these do you live in? Right. Do you live? Is your house a cheap inn, a prison, a madhouse, or a latrine?
You can't expand the list.
Yeah, I'm sure you can expand the list.
Why did he come up with those four?
Yeah.
Well, let's go with the prison. Why would there be within the West the notion that to be at home in the world is to be in a prison? That goes back, let's say, to something like Platonic philosophy, where people would and certainly within Christianity as well, some understandings of Christianity, where what? The body is the prison of the soul. So our real self and what's good is imprisoned in this bad, evil body. And of course, the world, because it's material too, is simply that big prison. Some of you might remember, this was in the old Missouri hymn book. If you remember that, so that as I as a kid growing up, I was Missouri Synod, and one of the songs, we had a pastor that for confirmation made us memorize everything in the hymn book and psalms. That psalms are good, that hymn book was bad, especially hymns like this. I won't sing it for you, but have you heard this hymn? I'm but a stranger here, heaven is my home. Earth is a desert drear, heaven is my home. Dangers and sorrows stand round me at every hand. Earth is, heaven is my fatherland. Heaven is my home. Right? There you go. That's pretty much earth is, right? This home is prison. That's the kind of stuff. And, you know, the cheap inn is just, it's a place where we stay here for a little while, you know, we're not going to stick around and everything. So, yeah, it's kind of like the room in your lodge, whatever, you know. It's good enough for a week and then psh, we're out of here. Madhouse, well, that goes back to absurdity, contingency. I mean, you know, living in this world is just nuts. And the latrine is, well, we all know shit happens. And it just so happens that where I live is where it always seems to be dumped. No, I mean, that's what Kant is really saying. So, you know, in that sense, each one of those metaphors, I think, do help illustrate, again, within the West, what people think life here in this world, in their home, is all about. But certainly, there can be other metaphors. I mean, you know, can we ever be at home in the world? Well, do you have a different metaphor for home? I mean, that's certainly a very good way of trying to respond to this question. What is your metaphor for home? Because it
combination.
Combination. Mm-hmm. And what is that combination?
Well, it could be I'm at home in my prison in my world, but shit still happens.
Oh no! Oh no!
You're in the prison retreat.
Right. So you're in a your jail cell is also an outhouse.
And you think it's okay.
And you think it's okay. There we go.
Actually, that gets me to the first thing that I looked at on C is the word can the right word? Is it, should we ever be at home in the world? But that's placing a value on it that I suspect you're not so interested in.
Well, we're not tied to anything here, are we? We can make this should. What does that change the way you would answer the question?
We have a choice.
Well, since we're just changing words, quoted John. World in the New Testament is translated three different ways in Greek. One would be ecumene, the inhabited world. One would be Gaia, the earth. And then the third would be cosmos. And so in what sense are we at home in the inhabited world, that is, with our brothers and sisters? What sense are we at home in the natural world with the earth that you imageful brought to life in the sermon, that we're dirt, and then the cosmos in this larger divine ornament and creation.
Another thought that comes to me is of Genesis, where, you know, we have the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, and then they're kicked out, they're no longer at home. And that's sort of the sense that a lot of people have of there was a perfect world, but it's no longer perfect, and we've been kicked out of our real home.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that would be another way of asking the question: should? I think there we probably want to say can rather than should.
Right.
Can we ever get back to the garden?
And since we're talking about Greek words, oikonomē is household, is the basis for both economy and ecology, which really have to do with relationships. That's really what it is all about, is how things interact or how people interact.
Sure, oikoumene, or nowadays we would call it our economy, the inhabited world and the household and all of those things. We can also talk about ecology. And both of those, and what world is always wanting to talk about precisely, is the sense of relationships. And how we formulate and live out those relationships. And can those relationships ever be a sense of total harmony, justice, peace, well-being, wholeness? Those are the kinds of words we could use to try to amplify this some more.
Well, I'm thinking of even people that have been in prison. I think Carol was the fellow who was in on Starting Holden. I believe he was in prison in part of his life, and Bonhoeffer, and rather than dealing with the unpleasantness of everything, they made it, as crummy as it was, that was their home at that time, and they did something with it. And I can't think of who the author is, the Dutch, the lady who ended up and seeing the awfulness of the Germans and what was happening. Corrie Ten Boom. And so isn't that for all of us? What are we doing with the circumstances in which we find ourselves? And I don't know if that's called, I mean, at home, but are we making lemonade, or, and sometimes just struggle is what's coming out of it all.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts?
Well, I think the prison, as far as I see it in my life, is we age too quickly. Oh, we don't age too quickly. The years go by too fast, and all of a sudden we think, my goodness, here am I. And there is a limit to what we can do and what we can expect. And we'd like to say, God, how about 20 more years? How much could I do?
Mm-hmm. It means you've had a good life. It's a great thing.
Good or not, I've liked it. I'm not complaining.
Go ahead.
I worked at a county prison for a short period of time in my life in the infirmary, and I'm just thinking about this idea of prison and how being in a prison, everything works very effectively and very well as long as people go along with the rules. When you start getting people that don't like the rules and start rabble-rousing, the whole thing can fall apart. And I'm just trying to look at what that means when we look at this idea of relationships. If people don't challenge relationships, things never get shaken up and that system stays the same. If the economy never gets challenged, it stays the same and it perpetuates that idea of prison, of external controls in many ways. And I think God calls us to challenge the external controls in our lives. So maybe life is a prison, but it shouldn't stay that way. I mean, I think that we're called to try to change it. And probably if it's a latrine, we're called to change it. And probably if it's a madhouse, I mean, I really think that that's part of what we're asked to do as people of faith.
Mm-hmm. I'll just throw something out. It seems like prison and has been one of the main words that people have been drawn to. So if it was a latrine, I guess, on the one hand, yeah, we see that as connected to death, right? It's our own earthiness, our own crap. But on the other side, I think of that other gospel reading where it talks about we are the shit, we are the manure that you put around the tree that is dying in order to maybe help it live again, to provide the sustenance for it to grow. So maybe the fact that the world is, we are the latrine, maybe that's also the gift side of that, there's a grace in that too. There you go.
So that the sequel to the sermon, you are dirt, is you are manure?
We are good manure.
You can give that sermon.
Well, as someone who grew up on a farm, right? So we certainly made use of that chicken. Yeah, sure. Shit, in order to, you know, make great tomatoes and potatoes in the garden. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is that parable of the extra year for that tree. I mean, that, mm-hmm. you know, tending, manuring, gardening, tilling, and that's kind of that, you know, as people of God, we are to be fertile like that. So, I mean, it's an image that's there. Our time, of course, is escaping us, which is always an evil. But let me give one other metaphor for home, because we don't have to do that. From the Christian perspective, I think a notion for home is the home can be church. And what I mean by church here is back to that Greek word, ekklesia, which literally means the called out ones, the gathered ones, and that our notion of can we be home in the world? Yes, our home is where we are called out for the sake of Eucharist. I think if you think about that within the liturgy of the Eucharistic service, right? Where is it that we are really gathered and that we are at home in terms of these notions of relationship in that? And you can say the whole service itself, of course, but the real, where we really get homey in church is when we all gather around the table. Isn't it? Where Christ, as the host, invites us all to come forward, to come, if you will, I think it's all, with the altar and come gather around the table. We are at home. Now, are we at home in the world? Well, yes and no. Right? And I think that's good to be yes and no. That's that sense again of we don't want to be too comfortable because you could sell your souls at that point. But on the other hand, yes, we are at home. And that sense of, I think, being at home in the world for us as Christians is a sense of Eucharist, of thanksgiving, where we are gathered there, and it is our home where we see one another as brothers and sisters, with all the faults and all the flaws and all the evils, and yet how graciously, lovingly, God at work in us, and we at work in and on one another, right? Establish God's economics, God's ecology, so that we can be at home in the world. So that I think, if you will, one of the key things that we have as Christians in our arsenal, to put it that way, against evil, is the Eucharist. And think about that as the way in which we are enabled to be at home in the world and the kind of power that is there to confront all the evils that are there. That's where I will end. And I thank you for your patience and attention and working through some evil things. Thank you very much. Thank you.